show. My parents are gonna think I'm such a burnout.
Welcome back to Horror Hunks, where we discuss the movies we love and the hunks we lust. I'm the jock, the whore, the scholar, and the fool, but I'm no virgin, Chris Waltz. Filling in for Stu, we have my comic book buddy and fellow horror-loving queer, Sal Williams.
Perfect.
So how are you doing?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. For anybody who has no idea what's going on, and we don't have to tell you this because the magic of editing, this is a re-recording because I somehow messed up the file of the last time we recorded this like 2 or 3 months ago. And so now we're doing like a fresh, brand new one before it releases. So
the magic of podcasting.
What was that?
The magic of podcasting.
Yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing is with some of these episodes that we've been releasing, we recorded them like 6 months ago. And so like, it's just really funny that this one is now going to be recorded like 2 weeks before it releases, whereas some of them were recorded like 5 or 6 months before they released.
Love it. Love it.
Yeah. So for the uneducated masses, how do we know each other?
We know each other because we either started following each other on IG or Twitter talking about, I feel like we started talking about comics first and then discovered we had a love of horror movies.
Yes. Yeah. And so we had this whole, I think we started following each other on Twitter and then moved over to Instagram when I was doing the whole like Bookstagram thing that I don't do anymore.
Yes.
Yeah, but we talked a lot about comic books because we're both like X-Men fans or Marvel fans. We both love Nightwing.
And then you were going to New York, and so I gave you some recommendations. I think we had.
Oh yeah, I forgot about that. I was going to New York back in December.
Like maybe a week or so.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I forgot that you gave me all those recommendations, and then I couldn't. You gave me comic book store recommendations. And the Midtown Comics was the one that you were like, you have to go. And we went on the last day that we were there. Like, we had to literally catch the plane like an hour, like be at the airport an hour later. And we got there and Midtown Comics didn't open for another hour. So I didn't get to go.
Oh, well, yeah, you'll have to go back.
Yeah, exactly. But so we started with this love of comics, love of X-Men. We actually haven't talked about comics in a while because I haven't been reading, but who are kind of your go-to characters?
Ooh, go-to characters from comics or from X-Men?
Both.
Okay, go-to characters from comics, obviously Nightwing, Flash, Robin, Dick Grayson, my absolute favorite. I also really like, I mean, I'm a kid of like the 90s, so when DC was doing their whole Death of Superman, Nightfall, where they replaced Batman, they also replaced Wonder Woman and Green Lantern. So my introduction to Green Lantern was Kyle Rayner, who's kind of fallen off in popularity, but for, you know, a whole generation of comic book nerds, that was their Green Lantern. And then if we're transitioning over to Marvel, I know they're so basic, but the Summers brothers, like Scott and Alex, Havoc and Cyclops, I know they're basic, but there is just something about them, especially Alex's little Inferno Demon Goblin King get up, if you know what I'm talking about. Ooh, yes.
You've sent me that frame so many times.
How about
but here's the thing though. So one, I don't really know much about like DC characters. I just know that I love Nightwing, I love Batgirl, and I hate Superman. That's really all I know.
There you go. That's all you need to know.
And then, like, there was a comic a while back. I think it was like Super Sons,
with Clark Kent's son, and then Damian Wayne, the son of Batman.
Yeah, and it was kind of when I realized that like Damian Wayne is a sociopath.
Oh, for sure, he was raised by Ninja Assassin.
I didn't even know that part. I just read like Super Sons because it was about their kids, and then I realized like that Damian Wayne is the worst. And then, so, like, as far as X-Men go, here's the funny thing. Love Havoc / Alex Summers. He is probably in my, like, top 10, I would say. Especially because of, why can't I remember the name of this book that ran last year?
Hellions.
Hellions, yeah. Hellions is, like, probably one of the best comics that has ever existed.
Hands down.
But I hate Cyclops. He's the worst, like, probably bottom five mutants of all time.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. And it's like, I know it's like, I don't know if it's like a controversial opinion, because I feel like people either really, really love him or they really, really hate him. But I really, really just dislike him. And I think part of it's like the movie portrayals are where I got a lot of my information from as a kid.
I've been kind of down on this whole, like, I mean, depending on when this comes out, Krakoan Age, and like, are they in an open relationship with Jean and Wolverine and Emma? Are they not? Like, all this, like, gay subtext. Like, maybe that's where I'm
as for him. As somebody who is in a polyamorous relationship, I would love for them to just officially say it so that it doesn't feel like this taboo 100%. Thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 100%. Great.
Like, because I feel like the way it is right now is like they're like teasing it that like Jean is with Wolverine, but Jean is also with Cyclops, but maybe Wolverine and Cyclops kind of have a thing too. They're like teasing it, but they'll never officially say anything. And
I'm
I just
afraid,
wish that they would like do it.
Piss off the fanboys.
Yeah, there and like there was like this one thing that came out, and we're like really off topic, and we'll jump into the movie in a second. But like there was this one thing that came out a while back. I think it was the beginning of the Krakoan era, and there was a map of like where they lived, and the rooms were conjoined.
Yes. 100%.
Okay. Well, officially, I think we've decided that Scott, Jean, and Wolverine are just in a polyamorous throuple, maybe? I'm not sure, but...
Well, and then Emma must come in every so long with, like, a strap on or something. I mean, Emma has some BDE energy, like...
I've grown to love Emma Frost so much in the last, like, 2 years. Emma Frost, Mystique, and Destiny are like probably three of my favorites right now. And I didn't like any of them before this current like run.
Well, not to spoil anything, but the cover has been released, but Emma and Tony Stark are apparently getting married.
I did see that. And I'm so far behind. I stopped reading like regularly like after last year's Hellfire Gala. And I read like most of Judgment Day, which I think I texted you about. But I just, like, fell off again, and I'm like, okay, Hellfire Gala, July, I'm jumping back in, but we'll see what actually happens.
There we go. Speaking of Tony Stark, or Chris Hemsworth was in this movie. Look at that transition.
Was he, or was it the other one? I always get them confused.
Chris Hemsworth,
yeah. So, jumping into the horror side of things, because Sal and I are also both horror fans, and that is another way that we're friends. We're talking about The Cabin in the Woods tonight. A very fun meta, I think it's one of, if not the newest movie that we've actually talked about on the podcast to date. This will be episode 9, and I think everything that we've talked about before and anything that we're going to talk about in the remaining episodes of season 1 are all older than this movie. So I think it's interesting that we have a 2010s horror movie on here to kind of just like compare and contrast what it would be like now versus what movies were like back in the 80s and 90s. What are your initial thoughts of this movie?
Well, I mean, hearing you kind of do that lead up, I also had this thought, like one of arguably the only, I mean, not the only, but like a horror film that just needed to be one and done, right? I mean, we'll get to the end of the story. You can't really continue it as a sequel, and you don't really need to do any prequel, but it's like almost a perfect standalone film. And we don't really see that too much, especially in the horror genre, right? You're always getting a sequel, a reboot, what do they call it in Scream? A requel, thank you, right? So this is a great example of tell a good story and just walk away.
Yeah, and I stand here with movies of any kind, but specifically horror, because horror franchises are kind of just like a known thing. But I've said it a lot about books in the recent past too. My attention span is out the window since like COVID lockdown a couple years ago. And so I think we need more standalone movies. We need more standalone books. Part of the reason why I fell off reading comics was because you had to buy like 10 different books to get the whole story. I love the idea that this movie is very standalone. They do not in any way, shape, or form leave it open to a sequel. I mean, it's been over 10 years. We can say confidently the movie ends with the end of the world. And yeah. So we don't have, I mean, I just, in a world where we're so used to those final scenes of a horror movie being a setup for a sequel, because look at, like, I Know You Did Last Summer, where he dives through the mirror at her, and, like, we get those little, like, basically end of the movie epilogues that let us know we're going to get another one. And this movie, you just absolutely, there's no possible way, and I like that about it.
Taking a little bit of a right turn, I do appreciate the Scream franchise. I mean, it, full disclosure, my favorite horror movie franchise, but everyone could conceivably be the last iteration because they don't do that jump scare, oh, Ghostface is still out there. So it's like, if the company or the cast walked away, it could end, the audience would be happy, but it's also still open for sequels.
Yeah, and it's actually one of the few horror franchises where, like, Ghostface is the killer, but it's always different people under the mask. Whereas something with, like, Michael Myers or Jason or Freddy Krueger, like, it's always the same person that they bring back every time. So with, like, Scream, it's kind of the infinite franchise, right? Because somebody can always take up the mantle.
Except for those weird occasions, right? With, was it Friday the 13th and Halloween, where they tried to go left and do someone new and the audience is like, no, thank you. And they're like, just kidding, Jason and Michael Myers are back.
Yeah, it's so funny because, like, every you're active on Twitter, every couple of, like, months somebody or, like, a group of people will just, like, start going off on how great Halloween 3 is, which, like, it's fine, or people will start going off on how awful Friday the 13th Part 5 is, and I actually like Part 5, like, as a standalone type thing, but I just think it's so funny that, like, there's all these people in the horror community who just feel the need to remind us that, like, hey, Halloween 3 is actually really good, or hey, Friday 5 is actually really, really bad. And, like, they just, like we don't remember, you know?
Right, right.
So, like, just sort of setting up the plot of this movie, we have, it's so strange because it's set up like a typical teen slasher. You have these group of, what, five teens who get together. They're in college and they're going away for a cabin weekend out in the middle of the woods. They're just going to party and have a good time. And I think part of the plot, like the very loose plot on purpose, is I think they're trying to, like, maybe get Dana, which is one of the main characters, to hook up with one of the guys because she's, like, recently out of an inappropriate relationship with her teacher. But so I think, like, the whole point is, like, getting her out there and, like, getting her to feel better, like you see in so many slasher movies, right? And so, but we also have this side of the movie where it starts and we're getting these people in, like, a lab, and they're talking about something that's happening. We don't really know what it is at first. And this is one of those movies where I feel like watching it for the first time, I don't remember what I was thinking, but it had to just be so strange because you think you're going into a slasher, but it starts out and there's these people in this, like, bunker essentially setting up everything that's happening in the movie. And I really, really like that about it.
Yeah, and I like that they mentioned, I mean, you know, we talked about that it was a one and done, but they do this really cool thing of, like, building up this mythos that you can kind of create in your own mind without saying anything, right? I mean, to your point, they mentioned the Stockholm, they mentioned multiple sites, Stockholm failing, and then it kind of comes down to a site in Japan, site in USA. So you already do this really cool world building with just a few almost throwaway lines. And, you know, I've rewatched this in the last few years a couple of times, and just the level of world building is pretty darn awesome. I mean, you know, as canceled as he is now, Josh Whedon was always really good about world building and also team dynamics.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is a testament to whether it's his involvement in the movie or anything else, because, like, let's be honest, I'm a huge Buffy fan, I'm a huge Angel fan, like, I'm always going to have that place in my heart for those things that he did. He can be a monster, and I can still, like, have that respect for his work that he did back before we knew he was a monster. Yeah. But I think one of the testaments to whoever's decision it was in this movie was that with as little backstory as we get, we are told so much through just like context clues and little visual things here and there. We know that this is something that happens like at least every year. And we know that pretty much every country participates in it. And that, you know, there's kind of this whole idea that it's always going to be the USA or Japan who figures it out. Even though at the time, we don't even know exactly what they're figuring out. They do a very good job of like building that world, letting us know what's going on without telling us too much.
There is a line, jumping ahead just a little bit, when, you know, our group gets to a gas station that I keep coming back to, and this is, again, we're, you know, now I'm speculating, but the gas station attendant says something to the effect of, you know, I served in a war, you would never survive. Kid goes, which war? Gas station attendant goes, you know which war? Which, you know, trying to think 2010 to make that bold statement of, like, you know which war, also makes me think, like, you know, this could be a world that we're seeing in a very specific POV, but maybe was ravaged by war. Maybe this is a known secret about the underground bunker. Again, totally speculating, but again, one of those world building things that leaves the audience to create a narrative in their mind.
Well, it's one of those things, like, this movie's just strange enough to where that would make perfect sense. They never explicitly tell us that this is happening.
Correct.
But there are these little breadcrumbs throughout the entire movie to where, like, we can assume a lot of things. And in the end, because of how the movie ends, it doesn't really matter if we're right or not.
True.
But I kind of like that idea because, again, it's like, you know which war. And it could just be a funny throwaway line that this guy is just so, like, weird and goofy. But it could also be, like, a very specific meaning of something. So, yeah, it's kind of fun that we can... This is the kind of movie that we can make those kind of assumptions, and it's okay if we're wrong, because, like, everybody dies in the end. So, yeah, the movie goes along, and they get to the cabin, and it, again, it just is very much set up like any just, like, typical slasher. And I think explaining it in words is kind of does no justice for how the movie goes, because it's so... obviously trying so hard to be just a typical slasher that we know that something's up. And so, like, the group is what? It's Kurt, Marty, and Holden are the three guys. Dana and Jules are the two girls. And they are going through this cabin, and they're just, you know, they're drinking, they're having a good time. We're kind of learning that some of their personality traits are maybe not typical of them, which plays into the plot later on. But, like, Jules is acting like a little dumber than she normally does, and Kurt is acting like more macho than he normally does, and we're kind of learning that, like, something's up with our main characters as well, which is just another really fun tidbit to the movie when we find out what's going on with them. But basically, they end up in the basement of this creepy cabin where nobody should be. And how does it play out? They're just sort of, like, playing with different trinkets.
Yeah, well, getting to the basement was interesting because, right, they're playing truth or dare, and then someone picks truth, and the cabin door blows open, but it blows, like, upwards, and then someone says something like, oh, it could be the wind. You're like, the wind from below the earth inside? We know, right, because we are the audience, that the people in the bunker press the button to, like, release the door, but they're acting like, oh, this is pretty normal that a basement door flies open inside this way because of wind.
Well, and that's kind of a good point, too, because Marty, who's played by Fran Kranz, he's kind of like the goofy stoner of the group, but he's also the only one of the group who, when this weird stuff is happening, when that door blows open from the ground, he's like, what wind, guys? Like, this is not normal. He's the only one who's realizing that something's wrong.
Yeah.
And we later find out it's because of his weed.
Because of the weed. Yeah, exactly. Which is kind of interesting that it turns that kind of narrative on its head. Because usually the stoner is the one who doesn't see in movies, right, the truth. And this one, it gives the in-universe characters an excuse not to listen to the stoner. But the audience is like, turn around. Listen to the pothead. He is telling the truth.
Well, and it's so fun because he's kind of, like, played off as this kind of, like, conspiracy theorist. And, like, this whole time he's like, oh, they're, like, the government's watching us, and, like, oh, they're out to get us. And it's like, oh, wait, they actually are.
Right.
When they end up in the basement, because even when that door blows open and Marty tries to tell them that it's not normal, they go down there anyway. And the whole time he's like, okay, let's go back upstairs. Like, this is weird and scary and I don't like it. But they start playing with these different trinkets, and essentially whichever one they kind of like land on as their main item is, it summons a creature or group of creatures that is going to initiate this kind of like test, right? And so yeah, I love it.
Go ahead.
I just love the juxtaposition with while they're figuring out the items in the basement, we have the people in the bunker that are like taking bets
of which one they're gonna land on. Well, yeah, I was really fascinated. I mean, like, it's not a long scene, but I was really fascinated with all of the objects. It's like, okay, this guy's gonna blow the seashell, the conch, right? And that's gonna release the mermaid. And then you have the, what is it, puzzle box from Hellraiser? But in this, it's a,
yeah, and I think it's like kind of like a riff on it.
Yeah, for sure. And then there's the ballerina creepy doll music box that you see in every horror movie, but they end up with the journal?
It's a journal. It's Patience Buckner's journal.
Yes. That describes some fairly horrific deaths, including stuffing mom's stomach with coal.
Well, and like the whole thing, and they mention it in the movie, but like apparently this family is very violent and messed up. But then they mention the husband bulge, which I'm guessing, like, I feel like it's like an erection.
Oh, yeah.
But like, I guess like making these murders or whatever gives the dad like an erection, and she writes about it in the journal, and it's just like, wow, this family was so messed up. But it's not just like the creepy family that comes, they're dead, they're zombies, so that makes it even scarier.
What do they call them? Because there is a difference, right? There's zombies and there's zombie hillbillies.
Yeah, it's like the zombie redneck torture family, I think.
That's what it is. Thank you.
Yeah.
I was looking through my notes.
Yeah, and it's just so funny because, you know, they took the bets on who was going to summon the witch creatures. And, like, if you look at the board, there's probably, like, 30 or 40 different options up on the board that they're betting on. And so, like, you know, the only way that I feel like we would ever get, like, a prequel to this movie was if they showed us some of the past iterations and, like, what they fought. But then it kind of defeats the purpose because we know they're going to win. But I think it would be fun to see, like, oh, the year before, who was there and what did they, you know, what did they have to face off against?
I mean, listen, they could easily do, I mean, not spoil the movie that's, what, 15 years, 20 years old now, do a side movie where, right, because it ultimately comes down between this group in the cabin in America and little school-age girls in Japan fighting a spirit. I mean, the Japanese girls, they end up winning, right, and turning the spirit into a frog. So imagine these girls go through this horrific thing in their school, they're fighting the demon, bury the ring, turn it into a frog, only to turn around and die 10 minutes later because America fucks it up.
I didn't even think about that. These poor girls, they went through all this, like, torture, and they saved the planet in their eyes, and then they all just died anyway. I didn't even not even think about that.
Right? There's your sequel right there.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then, you know, the torture redneck murder family comes as zombies. And, you know, again, large chunks of this movie play out like just a typical slasher, because you have Kurt and Jules, who are a couple. Kurt is Chris Hemsworth.
Well, before Thor, right? He's definitely
pre-Thor.
Definitely has not bulked up. Definitely has not gone through the Marvel muscle machine.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember who plays Jules. It is Anna Hutchison, who I actually don't know much about. But yeah, so you have Kurt and Jules, who are, they're going out to just basically have sex in the woods, and things get very typical slasher when the zombie murder family shows up. But again, there's all this meddling coming in from the people in the bunker, because they're changing like the mood lighting with the moon, and they're changing, like, they're like exuding the pheromones out of the ground to make them want to have more sex and be hornier. And it's just sort of funny to me that, like, it makes me think about how, like, if there was a Friday the 13th movie and we were seeing the behind the scenes of like how this was all happening. If like all these horror movies that we've seen in the past are iterations of this test that they go through. And I know it doesn't really, yeah, like, if you think too hard about it, it doesn't make sense. But it would just be so funny if it was like, oh yeah, Jason is one of the things that you can summon from the basement.
Even the archetypes, right? Like, you know, at the very beginning, she's presented as a dumb blonde, but you quickly realize she's actually not. She's just happens to be blonde and she's smart. But then she starts demonstrating quote unquote dumb blonde behaviors. You find out that they've actually altered her brain chemistry to make her the stereotypical dumb blonde through the hair dye that she used to make herself blonde in a throwaway line at the beginning of the movie. So like the meddling, it's interesting because all these characters are archetypes on paper, but Chris Hemsworth, who's supposed to be kind of the assholey jock, is actually quite smart. He has a conversation with Jules at the beginning, right, about some sort of highbrow philosophy book, but then through their meddling with gases and whatnot, he becomes the like arrogant dumb jock of let's split up, let's do this, blah 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 blah.
Yeah, and I think the stereotypes, I always write them down wrong, but Kurt is the jock. And they say it in the movie, so if I say one of them wrong, there's always one that I always get wrong, but it's Kurt's the jock, Marty's the fool, Holden, who is Jesse Williams, by the way, we haven't really talked about him much yet, but Holden is the academic or the scholar.
Yeah.
Jules is the whore, and Dana's the virgin. And so they are. It is kind of these, like, those archetypes that you get from almost every horror movie, or at least, like, a lot of the really well-known ones. But again, yeah, like you were saying,
yeah,
our characters are made to be that way. They're not actually that way. There's even a line at the end when Sigourney Weaver pops up as kind of like the running this facility that's doing all of this. And she tells Dana, like, you know, you're the virgin. And Dana's like, virgin. And then Sigourney Weaver says, like, we work with what we've got. And so it's even like this throwaway thing where it's like, yeah, we know that you don't really fit the archetype, but like we have to do something.
Jumping ahead to the end, because you brought it up, I'm curious, yeah, like Sigourney Weaver, like definitely in my mind, an action heroine, and you know, Alien 3, right? Rides that fine line of is it horror, is it sci-fi? But I'm wondering, given the meta narrative of this movie, I'm curious if the role was maybe written for Jamie Lee Curtis or someone who the audience would easily associate with the horror genre, just given how meta it is, or if it was always intended for her, or if it was just not really thought about.
Yeah, I don't know, because I feel like as I watch it, Sigourney Weaver feels perfect in that role. It's like a 5-minute role. It's a glorified cameo.
Yeah, yeah.
But she feels perfect in it, but at the same time, it's like if it was Jamie Lee Curtis, I probably would have like shit myself in the theater.
Okay, let's go back to Holden, because you talk about Holden and you told me an interesting fact about him, and I immediately had to Google him, you know, podcasting being a visual medium. Boy oh boy, is he hot.
Yeah, and so, and that's kind of the thing, because Chris Hemsworth is in this movie, I feel like Frank Kranz, who's Marty, and Jesse Williams, who's Holden, get like kind of slept on. Because everybody knows, like, oh, Chris Hemsworth is Thor. And, like, that's all cool. That's great. He has abs. And he's Australian. Like, cool. Amazing. But Jesse Williams is, like, just a beautiful human being.
But they don't show it in the film. I mean, they make a point of they're at the lake, and he's the one who keeps his shirt on. And you're like, okay, fine, whatever. In the movie, it makes sense. The nerd never wants to get wet, blah, 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 blah. But I think you were telling me, right, they did that on purpose because he is ripped. I mean,
wait, who are you talking about right now?
Oh, wait, who are we talking about? Holden, right?
Marty, they kept Marty in baggy clothes because Fran Kranz is like Taekwondo, like mixed martial arts ripped.
Yes.
And then Holden, I think they show his body off a little bit, like in the lake scene, but they still kind of like overshadow his looks with like that scholarly. Like there's like the glasses they have him wearing. Like they use props with him very well to kind of like tone down his hotness. And he might be one who has like gotten more attractive with age because I saw him in Take Me Out in New York.
I forgot about that. Yes, you did.
And so, like, not only is he, like, buff, but he's also just, like, full frontal nude in that play. And, like, it's a very, like, don't get me wrong, it is a very, like, heartfelt, emotional play, and the nudity is never played for, like, sexiness.
Yeah.
But, like, there's also no denying when there's an attractive naked man on stage, like, you're looking. So, and actually in that play, there's, like, multiple naked men on stage all the time, it seemed like. So, like, there was that line of, like, oh, man, this is, like, a really good story, but also, like, oh, my God, Jesse Williams is naked on stage right now. And I've always been, with this movie specifically, I've always been a Marty fan because I just love the kind of, like, goofy, funny guy. But again, I feel like because Chris Hemsworth is in this movie, and not that he's not attractive, I just feel like he overshadows everybody because of, like, who he is and how everybody knows him.
Yeah.
But we also... What was that?
Marty becomes the hero.
Marty does become the hero because, like, as we go through this movie, everybody's getting picked off in their own ways. Marty, we believe, is killed, like, halfway through the movie. He gets pulled through a window and, like, maybe stabbed to death by the zombies, but we find out later on that he did not. He actually survived that, and actually he kind of facilitates the whole third act of the movie. But then we also have, like, Kurt, who, because he's the jock, he wants to save everybody or, like, go find help. And through a series of, like, very staged events with this bunker underneath the cabin, the cave that they have to drive through, like, is blown up and collapses so they can't leave. Kurt wants to use his dirt bike to, like, jump this giant gorge.
And he's almost successful, though.
He's almost successful. It's so funny to me also. Like, I get it. It's a movie. They're making fun of things. But, like, he has no ramp that he goes over or anything. He just, like, flat out, like, flat ground jumps this gorge. But because we're in this kind of, like, horror sci-fi, like, Big Brother's watching you moment, there's, like, a force field over the gorge, and he just smacks into it. And, like, essentially he explodes, I guess, as he, like, falls down into the gorge on this dirt bike.
But you see him hitting the force field, like, or him or the bike, right? Like, every, I don't know, what, 100 feet? You
just, oh, he's just, like, bouncing against it, yeah.
The force field. I mean, that took me out. I was, like, hilarious.
Yeah, it's so funny because, like, because I know they hinted at the force field at the beginning of the movie, but, like, watching it for the first time, I feel like it was just very unexpected. Like, they gave us enough time to forget about it.
Yeah.
And so he's like, he's going to save the day. And I'm thinking, like, oh, he's just not going to make it. And he doesn't. But it's because he hits this force field and bounces down it all the way, like, 300 feet down into the earth or whatever.
So while we're on the subject of Kurt, and we are all over the place in this movie.
It's fine.
No one's trying to follow it linearly. The whole premise is that, you know, this is Kurt's cousin's cabin, blah, 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 blah. But I didn't catch this line until my last rewatch. They say something to the effect of, come to think of it, Kurt never had a cousin.
So yeah.
The question is, like, Kurt was the one who initiated the saying, it's my cousin's cabin. He doesn't have a cousin. He clearly wasn't in on the murders. So was it just weird writing? Does he really have a cousin? That kind of threw me for a loop when I was like, oh, wait a minute.
No, because there's another line that, like, references it early in the movie, and I forget exactly what the line is because I haven't watched it for a few months because we're re-recording this. But essentially, like, there's when they get to the cabin, somebody is like, what's your cousin's name or something? And he just doesn't answer. Or, like, that may not be exactly what it is, but there's, like, a throwaway line where they're, like, referencing his cousin, but he just doesn't acknowledge it. And so, like, it's very much on purpose that he does not have a cousin, and they just kind of used him to get them to the cabin. And I think it's like they, you know, they mess with them. They made him the dumb jock. So I think maybe he just never questioned that he didn't have a cousin or something. It's just so silly.
Well, my advice to you, if you ever get a letter or a text that says, come to this cabin because you have a cousin you didn't know about, do not go.
No, probably not. No.
For all your listeners as well, do not go.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Bad idea. Don't go. Honestly, even if it's a cousin you do have, like, depending on how close you are, maybe just don't go anyway. But then we have, so Kurt, Jules is dead. She got sliced up earlier in the movie.
She got decapitated
with a saw. Yeah, disgusting. Kurt smacks into the force field. Marty, we think, is stabbed to death, somewhat off screen. And then as they're trying to escape, you know, we end up with like Dana and Holden are kind of the only two left. And they're trying to escape in the RV that they drove. And they crash into a lake, I think. Because they're driving and you don't know that one of the zombies is in the back of the RV and it stabs Holden through the throat.
Yes, because then you think that they're going to die in the river or the lake, right, a la Friday the 13th, but that's when we discover our stoner boy is still alive.
Yeah, because so Holden is dead and oh, so when he gets stabbed through the throat, he drives the RV into the lake.
Yes, into the lake.
And then so you have Dana gets out, but when she's back on the dock, the Buckners are like basically just beating her to death.
That was a really hard scene to watch. And Homegirl rebounded from that like it was a knee scratch.
Oh, yeah. So going into a lake in an RV, getting out, getting beaten by zombies. And then, like, Marty, we find out, is not dead and comes to her rescue, which is, like, a really kind of cute, cool scene because, like, you don't... And this is where, like, a big part of the movie where it subverts those expectations of a slasher because, like, Marty should not be one of the last ones alive. By the rules of these movies, like, he should have died when we thought he died, but he's actually alive and he saves Dana, who recovers very quickly, admittedly. And this is just where the movie kind of goes off the rails. And I all the way up to this point, it's just kind of like, okay, whatever. But then you get to this point where Marty has found this elevator in the ground. And, like, he takes Dana to it. And they decide, like, something's going on. I don't know if it could be me. I don't know if I could do it. But they take the elevator down, and that's when they end up in the bunker with all of the people we've been seeing in these other scenes who are controlling everything.
And all the monsters.
And all the monsters.
Or, and, they get, like, yeah. Creatures, yeah.
And they get to go on this kind of, like, great American, like, I forget what the term would be, this, like, special, like, Disney ride of a tour through the elevator where they're seeing all of the monsters, all of the creatures in their, like, cells. And they're seeing all of the ones where, like, that they could have chosen. And, like, you know, they come to the realization as well as, like, they made us pick what killed us in the basement. And it's, like, really cool to see some of these monsters. We've got, like, werewolves that comes into play later. The clown, the little girl with, like, the ballerina girl with the teeth in her face. Like, it's all just really weird, creepy stuff. And a lot of it,
homages to every horror film you can think of, and even some not horror films. There's a Jurassic Park reference in one of the monitors later.
Oh yeah, definitely. And that's what I was nearing to say is there's like so many references to different horror movies. You've got like I think even like references to The Strangers, yes. Which is like. It's not an obscure horror movie, but it's kind of one of those ones where you're like, oh, they put a reference to The Strangers in here. I feel like the scarecrows are a reference to something, but I don't know what it is exactly. Maybe there's a scarecrow. It's not like Pumpkinhead or anything like that, but the scarecrows scare me in this movie. They remind me of the scarecrows from Goosebumps.
I haven't thought of that guy in forever.
Pumpkinhead?
Yeah, oh my god, I know what I'm rewatching later.
I've never seen it, and I probably never will. It's like it's on my list of movies that I'm afraid to watch, along with like
okay.
Terrifier. I won't watch.
Oh, that I will not watch. There is a fine. I think we talked about this in the last recording. There is a fine line for me. I never really got with that torture porn vibe, right? Like I don't know. I can do Saw, but I can't do Hostel, and Terrifier falls under the Hostel territory for me.
Yeah, and, like, not to get too deep into it, but, like, people on Twitter really, really love to post about Terrifier 2. And I've never seen either of them, but the things that they post from Terrifier 2 ensure that I will never see it. Because it's just, like, too much for me.
I fully agree with you on that one.
Like more power to you if you love it, but not me.
Yeah, I'll be Ghostface stab a victim 1,000 times to Sunday and will not blink an eye. The minute you get to that like weird other kind of horror thing, I'm like, oh, my stomach does not like this.
Yeah, exactly. And then so getting back to the kind of what's left of the plot of this movie is they end up in the basement within the bunker. And through the fact of like the soldiers who work there, it's like it's obviously a government military like facility. Through the soldiers who are working there are basically trying to kill them in the right order so that they save the world. Our characters don't know this yet, but essentially they find a very convenient button that says,
why is that button? Let me ask you, why is that button a thing? If I was going to build an underground facility with horrific murder monsters, the last thing I would do is a handy dandy button for a release all.
It's a, what is it called? Is it a MacGuffin? Where it's just like, it's a plot device, right? I don't know like, what scenario they would have where they need to purge the facility, but they hit this red purge button that's not even like hidden. You don't need like the nuclear codes to make it happen, but they hit the purge button and all of the creatures are released from their cells. And it is just like 20 to 30 minutes of pure chaos. And I love it.
So quick little side tangent. Did this scene not low-key remind you, the more I watch it, Buffy season 4 with Adam and the, oh my God, please do not drag me, Buffy fan.
The initiative.
Does this whole scene not kind of like harken back to the initiative to you?
Yeah, and with this movie being Joss Whedon, he had to have like pulled from himself.
Oh yeah.
Because like for anybody who is the biggest definition of a sinner and hasn't watched Buffy, essentially the fourth season revolves around like a secret underground military facility where they're doing experiments on like monsters and vampires and demons. And in one of the last episodes, something very similar happens where, like, all of the demons get out and basically rampage the facility, very much like they do in this movie.
Yeah,
no, absolutely. And the correlation is 100% there, and there's no denying it. If it wasn't, like, a Joss Whedon-directed movie or written movie, I don't know if he wrote and directed or just directed, but if it wasn't a Joss Whedon-related movie, it would be arguable, but there's no arguing it since he's, like, involved with both properties.
Yeah.
And then, you know, so these creatures take over the facility. They are just slaughtering everybody. We have everything from a clown. We've got a unicorn. We get the merman, which is kind of like a comedic moment. The thing that gets me every time I watch this movie, I don't know why it's so horrifying to me, but Amy Acker is in the movie as one of the people working in the facility. Also like Buffy Angel alum. But this octopus arm just comes out of the ceiling and carries her away. And that's horrifying to me for some reason. And it may be like my fear of the ocean, but it gets me every time.
Okay, so no calamari next time we hang out.
No calamari. Okay. You know, when I was in LA in February, like we went to Long Beach and it was great because I didn't like get in the water because it was February. I won't go in the ocean.
A little bit of a California spoiler alert for those of you listening. I'm from California. The ocean is love the beach, love a beach barbecue, love a beach hang. The ocean is a little bit overrated. I absolutely prefer a pool to an ocean.
Well, and like I know some people who, like, of course, I was there in February. There was not going to be any going in the ocean. But I have a couple friends who are there right now, and they were like, "Oh, it's too cold to get in the ocean." And I was like, "It's June." When do you get in?
You don't? If you're in a shipwreck? I don't know. No. I mean, you know, it's fine, but octopus, shark, jellyfish, we're good.
Yeah, all of the above. No, thank you. Giant squids, not my thing. They can stay in the ocean and I'll stay on the land. It's cool.
There we go.
Essentially, so as all this chaos goes on, all the people working in the facility are getting murdered. You know, there's a few of them, like Bradley Whitford is one of them who we don't talk about him a lot in this movie or in the podcast, but he does an amazing job in this movie. I think he's the one who gets killed by the merman. I might be wrong. Flame me in the
comments. One of the scientist spends most of the movie talking about the merman. He was really hyped that, oh, they're going to blow the conch shell. It's going to call it the merman. And, you know, the merman is actually quite terrifying. And I don't know if it's because we're just all, you know, these beautiful mer people from Little Mermaid. But I saw the merman in here and I was like, you are a creepy, creepy person.
Oh, yeah. It's so gross. But at the same time, it's like so slow that they could probably like fight it off. But it is vicious, and like it always gets me when it's killing him that it's like blowing his guts out its blowhole. So gross. Just like a funny little like creative moment. As all of this is happening, Dana and Marty make their way like deeper into the basement where it's more of like a temple, and that's where they meet Sigourney Weaver, who is the—
and we've seen, while you check, we've seen the underground temple before, because after each kill, there's this, I'm assuming it's blood or a blood-like substance that flows through these ruins that seems to be feeding some sort of deity or some sort of god. And it's implied that with each sacrifice, that substance runs and pacifies the giant demon god underneath the ground. And so this is the first time we're actually like seeing people in there. And then Sigourney greets our last two survivors.
Yeah, and so she's the director. And so essentially her role is like over— I don't know if she's supernatural or not, or if she's just like high up in the government, but her role is that she's like overseeing all of these sacrifices to appease the old gods. And so like Sal was saying, you know, essentially after each kill, there's that blood that leaks out and is like appeasing them, and like they're getting ready for you know, all of these kills to happen. But essentially what the movie comes down to is that like Sigourney Weaver has to basically convince Dana to kill Marty, or else the world—
because the virgin needs to die last.
Yeah, no, the virgin has to die last. The fool is the only one left. And if she doesn't do it, then like everybody on the earth dies. And it's so funny to me because as like an edgy teenager, the decision they make where it's like, well, maybe we just need to let the world start over. As a teenager, I was like, fuck yeah, like stick it to the humans. We don't deserve this planet. As an adult, I'm like, what are you doing? You have parents.
Also, like, I was, you know, I had a little bit of a different thought. I mean, right now I was like, let the world end. Who cares? But I also then took a step back and said, Dana, your choices are kill— I mean, this is terrible, right? Context of a movie, no one come for me. Kill one person, don't kill the one person. He's going to die anyway because the world's going to end. So it didn't seem like much of a choice. He's going to die.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not even like they play it off like, oh, she's bluffing. This isn't really going to happen. They're just like, well, maybe we should just let the world end. And I'm like, then you are both going to die. Like, Marty's not surviving this either way you cut it.
Yeah. Right. So, homegirl, get out of here with your head held high.
And, you know, essentially they decide, Sigourney Weaver gets an axe to the back of her head, courtesy of one of the zombies. And
Sigourney Weaver is actually a very fun drag queen. Shout out Sigourney Weaver.
Please welcome to the stage, Sigourney Weaver.
Sigourney Weaver.
So, you know, she gets taken out. She gets an axe to the back of the head and falls into the pit. And then essentially Dana and Marty make the decision to just let the world end. And then the last shot of the movie is really cool. We have this like giant god demon hand shooting out of the ground where the cabin was, and it like smacks the camera and we know the world is ending. It's a shitty ending when you think about it, because like, who is going to make that decision? It's the edgy choice, but nobody, I don't think, is actually going to decide to do that. Maybe.
Under each country, or under each like lab, do we think there's different gods, or all the old gods just chilling together in the old god like hangout room, just ready to pop into wherever they lose?
I feel like they're kind of just like ethereal, incorporeal, and they just like show up wherever. Is my thought process on it. I'm not sure.
And then the world's over.
The world's over, yeah. The movie ends and the world ends with it. Kind of focusing in on these hunks. So, like, we had Kurt, we have Marty, we have Holden. We also had Truman, who was one of the military guys. I always like, feel like he gets kind of left in the dust because he is a cutie and he is a hunk, but he's just not in the movie that much. So, like, honorable mention to him. But, like, what are we thinking about these three main hunks, Kurt, Marty, and Holden? We've already talked about it a little, but, like, breaking it down, what are your thoughts?
Breaking it down, I would not kick any of them out of bed. You know, throw that out there. But I'm thinking Marty, Kurt, Holden.
You're ranking them bottom to top or top to bottom?
Verse? No, number one, Marty. Number two, Kurt. Number three, Holden.
Okay. So this is a little bit different than what we recorded last time.
And I blame you.
I don't know if your thoughts have changed.
Well, this is your fault. Because immediately after you told me about Marty, I did Google him.
Uh-huh.
And immediately changed him to my number one position.
Okay. So, like, my number one is tied for Marty and Holden.
Okay.
Because I've seen Jesse Williams like live in on stage and he's beautiful. Marty has got that geeky nerd face with the body of like a Marine. And then Kurt is like, again, he's fine, but he's Chris Hemsworth. And I feel like we've seen him in so many things that he's just not as appealing anymore.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. That's
yeah.
Well.
What we're going to say. So what I did, I ranked them. Actually, oh, wow. My ranking probably changes based on keeping in mind that this episode's a mess and I watched this several months ago. I had Kurt at a 9 out of 10.
Oh,
I had Marty
really?
At a 9 out of 10. And I had Holden as at a 10 out of 10.
Okay, okay. I mean, listen, they're all 9 or 10.
Yeah, Stu's not here to give his, like, wacky 70 out of 5 geeky glasses ranking or whatever it would be. But
that is too much math for me. Listen, I am an English teacher by choice. I 1 + 1 is too much for me, so more power to you, Stu.
Exactly. Stu always comes up with them on the fly too, and I'm not. I just do out of 10 because math is also hard for me. So what I'm going to say is because, spoilers, we have an upcoming episode that's already been recorded that's called Battle of the Hunks. And we are, this is going to be like our announcement of it, basically. But
ooh.
Battle of the Hunks is going to be the last episode of the season where Stu and I go through and we duke out our top hunk from every episode and
ooh.
Pick the best hunk of the season. And because before the episode was lost and we had to re-record it, Holden was our top hunk of the episode. So I'm going to say we're going to go ahead and give him that distinction again. For continuity's sake.
That is, listen, I co-sign that. He is, listen, they're all hot. Holden, you are our man. Our number one hunk for this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, they're all very attractive. Holden and Marty, I think, just hold a special place in my heart. Again, I've seen Holden completely full frontal nude, and he deserves this top spot.
I am so jealous.
All right. So as we wrap this up, where can people find you? Where, if you want them to like stalk you on your socials, because they will, you can throw that out there.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Mr. Nerdy Teacher. I am a teacher and a nerd, so the handle wrote itself.
Perfect. Thank you so much for being here twice, actually.
Of course.
You know you're going to be like in a season 2 episode that we won't have to re-record. But basically, thank you for recording the same episode with me twice in the same like 3-month span because I lost the audio. Thanks for being on. You're so great. You're such a good friend. And you're always like retweeting our tweets about the podcast. So we love that too.
Yeah, I mean, definitely spoiler alert, if you do follow me, it is going to be a lot of dumb teacher things and me just like reposting about horror hunks. And then every so often, some obscure reality show that I'm like binging.
We love to see it. We love to see it. And I'll put you a link to your socials like in the description of the episode too. All right. Thanks so much. It was so good to talk to you. And we'll probably like text you.
Oh, of course.
All right. See ya.
Later.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Horror Hunks. Your hosts were me, Chris Waltz, and our special guest co-host, Sal Williams. Join us again in 2 weeks when we discuss the Friday the 13th remake from 2009. Horror Hunks is a Dead Oaks production with music produced by Ben Bryles. Find us on Twitter @HorrorHunks, and until next time, stay horny, don't die.